but included the Homesteading Act of 1862, the Morrill Land College Grant Act, which recognized that education and opportunity and property ownership were all essential to the American dream. I'm proud that it was a Republican president, Teddy Roosevelt, that invited Booker T. Washington to dine at the White House, shocking official Washington at the time. I'm proud it was Republican President Dwight David Eisenhower who sent the 101st Airborne into Little Rock to make sure that Central High School was integrated. That a Republican President Ronald Reagan signed the King holiday into law. And I'm really proud to work for George W. Bush, a Republican president who has appointed more qualified African Americans to top positions than any president in American history, and who has an agenda. And who has an incredible agenda. But despite this progress, the fact is this. For the last several years, and up until I think this last election, no matter how much we might have said we achieved, the Republican Party did a bad job. It did not.
At all now. Even the raggedy Republicans are trying to claim that they're an ambassador to freedom for black people. This just doesn't get any crazier. Let me start off with one name. Trent Lott. Mr. Southern segregationist had won back in the day. According to Trent Lott, the world would be we wouldn't be having all these problems. Now we know what this person ran under, what slogan he ran under in the 1940s, segregation forever. None other than another name in the legendary Republican coffers once he transferred over to the Republicans, Strom Thurmond. You got Nixon, who started the New Kill program. Guess what? To kill us. Democrats, Republicans, there's only one place for you, where your Pope is at. You know what time it is. You're listening to 104.1, 101.1 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUBER.com, The World, RadioFraud.net, The Universe, and tune in to your Slave Revolt Radio blog by punching in Slave Revolt Radio in your Google web. Tonight, we're going to shoot our way into a Beyond the Shadow segment and deal with Sam's basic contempt for humanity, and then we'll explore that in all of its levels. So we got all that and a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
Seekers everywhere, I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
on a Beyond the Shadow segment. We're going to deal with in contempt of humanity. You know, the empire of America's international corporations and its market force continues their westward expansion of capitalist expansion, their privatizing drive of the world's life forces have left them exposed for all willing to view, like a person who's full of body tattoos. The contempt of humanity these capitalists have recently have exploded back into the scene somewhat concerning the issues of torture and what is being described as extraordinary rendition. This legacy of contempt for humanity has its roots deep in America's soil. So listen as we go through and try to flush some of this out. On KQED's NPR show, Talk of the Nation, Neil Cohen hit the airwaves with a guest. And they discuss the issues of suspects and rendering people off into countries that Sam knows commits torture. So first he has on Michael Hirsch, who's the senior editor of Newsweek. And Cohen asks, what's the logic behind Sam using extraordinary rendition? So let's check out what Hirsch has to say. And then let's take it from there.
With extraordinary rendition, what's the logic behind this?
Well, I think the logic behind it was that this was, you know, as the administration never tires of saying, a very new war that existed in some sort of penumbral state between actual war, outright war, where you take prisoners and you give them the Geneva Convention protections, and a previous approach, which was mainly favored by the Clinton administration, of treating the terror attacks as a law enforcement problem, where you go and arrest guys and you put them on trial. There was a sense that this was, you know, we had to deal with it much more aggressively, there were no legal or indeed laws of war measures and provisions that accounted for what do you do when you capture, say, a Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who we now know is the mastermind in the 9/11 attack, and you believe he knows something about the Al-Qaeda network and very possibly about future attacks. What methods are you justified in using to extract that information from?
And again, put it in the context of the 9/11 Commission, for example, this has to do, again, with the whole focus away from criminal prosecutions toward intelligence gathering.
Right, right. And, you know, there has been an enormous debate ongoing in the intelligence community about the best kinds of, best methods of interrogations. Do aggressive, even abusive interrogations actually work? Many intelligence, many professionals who are involved in interrogation, both on the FBI and the CIA and the defense side, will say that, in fact, these kinds of interrogations often don't work because you get corrupted information from the individual in question. You get, you know, he'll say anything
to make the torture
stop. And a lot of it turns out to be just nonsense.
How spread is this practice? Do we know how many people have been extraordinarily rendered?
No, we really don't. There was some testimony before Congress last year. General Paul Kern at one point told the congressional committee that he thought that it might be as many as 100. It has not, you know, come to light where they're held in most cases. And there was one report in the Israeli paper Haaretz suggesting that a major detention facility was in Jordan. We in the media have focused on the one thing that we do know, which we did find out about, which is the sort of charter airline that the CIA has employed to spirit these guys from one place to another.
Others have called this the torture plane.
Some people have called it the torture plane. But we've obtained from mainly European aviation sources some rather extensive itineraries of where these planes have gone. And the latest development in that a couple of cases involving detainee lawsuits against the U.S. government, the itinerary of the plane has conformed to their account of being seized. And so it's turned out to be important corroborating evidence in a couple of these cases for what they say happened to them.
Now, once again, this exposes the barbarity of this raggedy system. Here you have a situation where Michael Hirsch is talking about there was a sense that the U.S. needed to deal with terrorist suspects more aggressively. But his form of aggressiveness, which he basically regurgitates from the administration and the agencies, is something that breaks international law. Yet at the same time, they use part of their argument and defense for invading a sovereign country like Iraq with the facts that Saddam engaged in terroristic, or in this particular case, torture techniques amongst people in the region, whether it's people he's fighting against or within his own population in and outside of his border. Yet this clown, this hoax of a journalist, turns around and regurgitates Sam's excuse without the slightest bit of irony. Then he has the nerve to say that there's been enormous debate, when basically the debate has been on false grounds, especially when you see people like Gonzalez, who are advocates of torture, basically go up the level within these various administrators' corridors. So what kind of debate can one really claim when butchers and barbarians are allowed to participate within some of the highest levels of the administration for the ruling class? He also then turned around when he was asked, how do you know, or how many people do you know have been rendered, you know, expedited out of the country, or out of the country where they were seized by the CIA or whoever, and then taken over to a fellow torture barbarian country. And he says he doesn't know. So he exposes himself in not really knowing the full spectrum of what is going on. He's in the dark. And like a typical corporate media henchman, he wants to be in the dark because he just wants to regurgitate out the PR lines that the administration puts out. See, this is not anything but a collaboration. Now, the mere fact that he's not seriously skeptical about what Sam is doing in the face of Seymour Hirsch and others breaking stories about the obvious barbarity of the U.S. empire towards human beings, Abu Ghraib and other places, helps expose how deeply embedded these corporate media henchmen are. Now, Sam's CIA kidnaps people in other countries, like an international terrorist, whisk them off to fellow torturing countries, yet if they're torturers that work on the side of Sam, like Total Constance, Emmanuel Constance, who was the leader of FRAP and who helped kill thousands of Haitian people during Aristide's first reign and helped toss Aristide out. Toto Constance is now kicking it in New York, alive and well, a torturer, a barbarian. So this is, the true light of Sam, and shows how deeply embedded these corporate media henchmen are. Now, this at the same time are many of the same people who are the Right to Life crowd. You know, you saw them crying about Shivo, you know, a few weeks ago. yet at the same time, they're running around torturing people like Mohamed Butt, who was tortured in this country when he was rounded up, when Sam was playing his race card. And he pulled out of his Ashcroft deck the Arab race card game. And Mohamed Butt got rounded up, got his bones cracked, ribs cracked, and ended up dying under this barbaric treatment. So for Michael Hirsch to play games with this type of issue gives an indication of just how vile this country is. Now next, a caller, Ray, asks Hirst, and doesn't this action create more hostility towards Sam? Let's see what Michael Hirsch has to say. Check this out.
Reno, Nevada.
Hi, thanks for the show. Just wondering, wouldn't this type of action actually create more anti-American feeling, especially if the wrong people are picked up sometimes?
Well, I think there's no question that it has. For Americans, the shame of the Abu Ghraib scandal and the photos that were published was that it did generate a lot of anti-Americanism and accusations of hypocrisy. An administration that is supposedly trying to spread freedom and democracy and human rights appears, according to many of these accounts, to be deciding on its own when it can breach those very standards. And so I think there's no question that it did create that.
What happens if wrong people are picked up?
Well, that's exactly what some of these detainees allege. And in fact, there's a lot of corroboration. In the case of Arar, he claims that when he was picked up, he was in transit to the United States back to Canada, where he lives and where he's lived as a teenager, after being on vacation with his family in Tunisia. And in fact, after this long period of very allegedly rough and abusive Syrian interrogation, he was released, and the Syrian authorities said they didn't think he had any connection to terror.
And the German man said to be a case of mistaken identity.
Right.
But three of these people have been released. Is that correct? At least,
well,
as far as we know.
A number of them have been released. Some of them have been re-detained, but you also have some British detainees that have been,
from Guantanamo.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So once again, a caller just asked some basic questions. And until pressed with more questions, or one particular question about what happens if the wrong people are picked up, this guy is not exploratory at all. Now, he then has to admit that some people have been picked up who are quote-unquote wrong. This whole thing is false. It's put on a false premise, because Sam is deeply embedded into this whole so-called ICADA network, and has been in the forefront of creating this operation that is now taking place. So just from that standpoint, it's clear how the corporate media has spun itself on its head intentionally to it doesn't know which way is up. But now it's taken this false premise of Sam fighting, quote-unquote, a true war on terrorism, and then starting with that whole construct and trying to flow from there. Now, to show how this stuff is continually perpetuated on, and how these right-wingers like to play the victim, one could look at Michael Savage's web, and he has on his website the video clips. Basically, they're going to the various insurgents' web links you know, the era of Webley, where they're going to Al Jazeera and other people and actually videotaping them cutting off people's heads. And so Michael Savage has on all of these, a number of people who get their heads cut off. It's not pictures, it's the full video, you know. So, but Savage is trying to get the blood up of his constituents. It's not an argument of keep your American cowboy boots out of these people's land where it doesn't belong, because you too may end up being a candidate for Tracy James' head coffin business in West Oakland. Now, that's not where he's coming from. He's basically trying to perpetuate the image that, see, these guys are the terrorists. These guys are the torturers. So you see, you know, a little chubby Americans get their head chopped off, and that's supposed to make you all riled up in anger and want to allow anything that Sam is doing under the sun to be perpetuated on and on. Next Cohen has included in this discussion Michael Shore. Now, Shore is an ex-CIA operative. He wrote that book, Imperial Hubris. And he asked Shore, what kind of individuals qualify for extraordinary rendition? So let's see how Mr. CIA X deals with this.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the CIA policy of sending some detainees into the custody of foreign nations, many of which have been accused of torture. A practice is known as extraordinary rendition. You're invited to join the discussion if you have questions about what this practice is, how it's used, and the arguments for and against it. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Michael Hirsch, senior editor at Newsweek magazine. He's with us here in the studio. Also with us in Studio 3A is Mike Scheuer. He was the chief of the Bin Laden unit at the Central Intelligence Agency under President Clinton and the author of Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. He joins us also here in Studio 3A, and it's good of you to be with us on the program.
Thank you very kindly, sir. It's a pleasure to be here.
You presided over this the use of this practice during your time at the CIA, is that right?
I did, sir.
And what sort of individuals qualified to be extraordinarily rendered?
First, let me say that there's two different programs we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo have nothing to do with the CIA's program. And the second point I would make is that the program was assigned by President Clinton and Mr. Berger, Richard Clark, to the CIA in 1995. And at that point, we said, okay, we're a service organization. We'll take down the cells, we'll dismantle the cells, and we'll help to have these people detained.
He's talking about Al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda. And we said, where would you like them taken? And they said, sort of, over to you. And the response from the agency was, no, you don't get it. We don't have police authority. We don't have prisons. Where do you want them to go? And they said, over to you. So instead of working with the Congress or with the intelligence committees who were fully briefed on the program to find a way to bring them to America, they left it up to us. And so we found we had to focus on those Al-Qaeda members who were, A, part of a legal process somewhere in the world, mm-hmm. B, in a country where we could persuade someone to arrest them, and C, have a country where we could take them to after they were arrested. Now, the agency's position would have always been more comfortable had we brought them to the United States. They couldn't do that for legal reasons. They weren't interested in trying to find a process they could be taken, so they went to third countries.
So if there was enough information to charge these people with criminal acts, you could have brought them to the United States and that would have been fine.
No, that's really not the case, because very few intelligence services or police services overseas are going to let the FBI accompany them on an arrest. Therefore, there is going to be no U.S. officer who can swear in court that this person was never roughed up, mm-hmm. that the papers or the computers were never tampered with. So the basic
chain of evidence question.
Chain of evidence question, sir. And really, I think in the on the long run, it's going to prove that we were too clever by half. The detention, the detainee program, the rendition program, has been the single most successful American counterterrorism program since 1995 till today. And we wouldn't be arguing about any part of it had Mr. Berger and Mr. Clinton and their successors now in the White House and the National Security Council worked with the Congress to find a way to bring these people to America. I might add one more thing. I think the media has covered this very widely, but they haven't covered it very thoughtfully. The goal of arresting these people was never to interrogate them. The goal was to identify people who were either going to participate in a terrorist attack on the United States or its allies, or someone who is involved in planning one. The first goal of the program was to incarcerate those people. The second goal was to get from them whatever paper documents they had and electronic documents where they were writing things that they didn't expect the enemy to read. Interrogation was always the least important aspect of the program.
So that you would find stuff out from these documents, either electronic or on paper.
The documents were always much more important than the interrogation because they were information that the terrorists or the fighters had written without any expectation of it being read by a United States intelligence officer.
This is just unbelievable. I mean, how in the hell, how would a so-called terrorist operative who is in U.S. ground, supposedly, to create terror, to create murder, mayhem against the American citizenry, and to supposedly knock a hole in the U.S. government, how could he not plan or even contemplate him or herself being caught? And not, and if they are caught, not having their documents that they're planning within this whole process being seized. I mean, this is just rhetoric. This is like some TV show where, you know, the befuddled, you know, terrorists are completely confused and in the dark about U.S. intelligence on 24 TV show, you know, the little TV show, confiscating their documents and their whole plans. What do they think they were going to take? The Quran and read that? I mean, this is this hocus pocus stuff. Then he does outline that some important stuff, which was already pretty well known, but this has to be clarified once again on a certain level. When he says that this was all set up, this extraordinary rendition stuff, during Crime Bill's administration. That's just another nail, once again, in the coffin of you lesser of two evils types. I mean, this is, once again, this exposes the Democrats' complicity in this whole global war, imperialist war, war on terrorism. Boy was just handed the baton by the Democrats and has continued on from there, just like he was handed the baton of the Patriot Act, which was in the form of crime bills, you know, effective death penalty, anti-terrorism act. So all these liberals and progressives types out in ozone land, it's time to breathe some fresh air. Now, he goes into this stuff about the administration said we must leave the members' location, you know, these people who we capture, the quote-unquote terror suspects, leave it up to the CIA. Now, that's nothing more than a wink and a nod to the agency because of the agency's known terroristic history. The Phoenix program, that's all CIA. The SOA manuals expose that the CIA's own documents and instructions on committing terrorists to mainly South Americans. So for administration to play the game of leave it into the hands of the CIA where these guys wind up. Basically, is the various politicians in Congress, in the Senate, presidency, etc., being in cahoots with this whole process of torture. So when you see cats like, buffoons and coons like Boxer and all of them try to belatedly express outrage, keep in mind that they're just playing a game. This is all a script. And they know that those who are locked into this whole electoral politics games will fall for this script. Then, Mr. Imperial Hubris has the nerve to say that this rendition process has been the most successful operation. Now, the obvious question, if this whole thing wasn't such a farce, for Cohen to ask is, well, how did 9/11 happen? I mean, if this thing is so successful, or is that how you mean it's successful? Because 9/11 did happen. How is it that the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq have come to be a complete farce? In other words, these guys in this extraordinary rendition, CIA, etc., are going around the world kidnapping people, operatives who are supposed to be engaged in terroristic action and torturous action. Now, they claim at the time that Saddam was involved in terroristic activity. So one has to assume, under their argument, that they had their gaze on him. After all, they were the ones who were making the claims that he was engaged in this type of stuff. And part of Saddam being a terrorist was linked to his weapons of mass destruction. Well, how did they get it wrong? It's all a farce. Now, he started off about this whole conversation saying that they told the administration that we'll take down the cells, we'll dismantle the cells, and help to have these people detained. Well, they didn't take down anything on the real. As a matter of fact, they helped construct these cells. It was the CIA in Saudi Arabia that was giving visas to people who were quote-unquote linked to later quote-unquote terroristic action. Sure, it's just a fraud. And the way this whole thing is constructed with Cohen on this NPR Talk of the Nation show is a fraud. Now, Cohen next asked, why take these people to another country for interrogation? So, let's see how Ashore deals with this.
Then why take the additional step, if the interrogations weren't very productive, of sending them on to Egypt, Syria, wherever?
Well, sir, let me run down a quick list of the people who have been taken off the street. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the man who planned 9/11. His deputy, Tawfiq bin Attash, who helped plan 9/11 and who planned the attack on the coal in Yemen. Abu Zubaydah, who ran all of Al-Qaeda's training camps in Afghanistan. Ramzi Ahmed Yusuf, the first World Trade Center bomber. Ramzi bin al-Shib, who was another sidekick of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and the Al-Qaeda chief in the Far East, a man named Hambali. All of these people were targets and are now off the street. Now, if you don't want them taken to a third country, then you release them. And would you...
Well, all those people, are they held in another country's custody somewhere?
I don't know where they are at the moment, sir. I'm not part of the organization anymore. What I'm trying to say is that if someone has a gripe with where they are, then please go see Mr. Berger, Mr. Clinton, Mr. Clark, and the Congress and the intelligence committees, because only they had the power to arrange to have them brought to the United States.
Okay.
Now, wait the hell a minute. Now, Shore is trying to say that, all these people were taken, quote-unquote, off the street. He's asked, are they still, quote-unquote, in custody in all these various places you guys may have taken them to? And this clown says, I don't know. Yet he just wrote a book. And within his book, it's obvious that he still has all these ties and connections. If he's truly making some argument in defense of this process, of course he knows. This whole thing is a farce. It's a complete farce. But this is how they run their game. But next, the G.I. Joe caller, Ron, he calls in and talks about the detainees at Abu Ghraib and its extraordinary rendition process that he had never heard the term before. Basically, it's just a Dirty Harry type of spill Mr. G.I. Joe gives.
Get some listeners involved in the conversation. This is Ron, and Ron is calling from Fort Hood in Texas.
Hi, how's it going?
All right.
Yes, I just want to call. I just got back from Iraq within the last month. I was over there for about 14 months. And saw the detention process from the task force detention all the way up into the processing of prisoners into Abu Ghraib. And I just wanted to say that the prisoners actually at Abu Ghraib are the ones that have passed screening at the task force level, then up through the brigade level, and then the ones that really fit the bill for the terrorists we're looking for and significant contributing factors to them being terrorists are the ones that are actually sent to Abu Ghraib.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that we actually have sent there have met all the requirements of guilt as far as I can see, that they're suspicious enough where by going to Abu Ghraib, there was a high expectation that they were their hands were dirty. However, and what I wanted to comment on was the extraordinary rendition process. And this is the first time I actually heard it called by that term, but I just want to say that I support it fully from being on the ground and trying to ascertain information from personnel that have planted roadside bombs or terrorist cells that are in action throughout Iraq, and them knowing that there's absolutely nothing we can do to them to get them to talk, because they know our policies, they know what our limitations are.
So you feel your hands are tied?
Our hands are tied, absolutely. And that would just put, it makes it much more difficult to defend a country when the people that are involved in attacking it know that there's nothing you can do to them if they just keep their mouth shut. Mm-hmm.
You say it's the first time you've heard it described as extraordinary rendition. What did you hear it described as?
I've never even heard it as a policy, as where we were transporting another country. That was something that my friends and I would talk about. Like, it would be great if we just turned it back over to their host countries and let them deal with the problem, because there's nothing we can do with them.
And Mike Troyer said, that's right.
Yeah, the lawyers call it rendition, but only the media that I know of have ever called it extraordinary rendition.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure what the term means, but if it was good enough for the lawyers, it was good enough for us.
Okay.
If I might make a point here to follow up on that, I think the grandstanding that we're seeing by Senator Leahy and Congressman Markey, Senator McCain, Lindsey Graham, is really a dangerous grandstanding if they focus on simply the idea that these operations are undertaken to do interrogation. If they're unhappy with the destiny of these people, of where they're taken, then they ought to fix a way to bring them to the United States. But again, I just hope if they pass this ban in the Congress with a gasconade of misinformation, that they also put their names on the paper that says, yes, we prefer to have Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Taufik bin Attash, and Abu Zubaydah on the street to protect their human rights rather than to take them to somewhere where they can be incarcerated.
Ron, thank you very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
All right, this is once again another example of why this empire has to be crushed. You know, when you have clowns like Ron, whether he's a real G.I. Joe soldier or not, the mentality and the lies and deceits, intentional, self-delusional, exposes the viciousness of the American mindset. You know, him talking about people sent to Abu Ghraib's hands are dirty. This type of collective guilt rhetoric, when it's already been exposed, a number of people who were in Abu Ghraib were innocent men, women, children, etc. I mean, this is some sick rhetoric. And then he talks about how he supports this extraordinary rendition process, and because of his experience of being on the ground dealing with roadside bombs. Look, when your little punk cowboy ass is in someone else's land where it has no legitimate business, then any means those people thrust upon the invaders is justified. You get the hell out. You're the one spreading depleted uranium all over these people's living quarters. Who the hell do you think you are? Now, he then falls under the same typical claptrap about good American people's hands being tied because these people know our policies. Look, fool, they know your policies, all right. That's why they're fighting so stringently. They know that you starved off over a million of their people during their sanctions. And during that process, you were bombing water stations, the electricity, you know, just going outside of the international law, making life for the Iraqi people a hell on earth. Then you throw all types of weaponry and go into a form of collateral damage that would have made Adolf proud with your own form of shock and awe blitzkrieg attack. So for him to pretend like Sam's hands are tied, you know, this whole Dirty Harry type of thing, if you just let us loose, we could really get at the problem. When at the end of the day, you're the problem. Death squads have been used by America all over the planet. It's used chemical agents in just about every war you can think of. It's spread it all throughout in Vietnam. It has mercenary terrorist force like Tiger Force throughout Nam. It had mercenary force that Che ended up having to have to deal with in the Congo, in the heart of Africa. So to hear this goon get up here and talk this type of rhetoric is just sick beyond belief. But to show how pathetic the whole corporate media setup is, now listen to Michael Hirsch, who, you know, the senior editor for Newsweek, now shaking his boots that this ex-CIA guy, Shore, is on, and flim-flam all over the place over the Abu Ghraib issue, as he, you know, you know, and all that. I mean, check this out.
Michael Hirsch, I did want to bring you back in on this. Is there a connection between this policy, which Mike Schroyer said is to be distinct from what happened at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo?
Well, he's absolutely right. I mean, one of the, you know, the tragedy of the Abu Ghraib scandal, as I've said before, I think on this show, is that what began as a you know, arguably legitimate program of rounding up these known bad guys, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Bin Attash, and others, and getting them off the street by whatever means, began to migrate in terms of approach and thinking and interrogation techniques to apply to all sorts of Iraqi detainees. And I think one of the reasons that the recently returned soldier who was just on suggested, you know, that he hadn't heard this term is because that was a separate, you know, it was a separate policy there. You're talking about an insurgency war and rounding up and detaining those guys. And yet many of the same practices and indeed the legal justification that the CIA was looking for in detaining these guys migrated, in the words of the Schlesinger Commission report this past summer, to other, you know, theaters of combat involving an actual war like Iraq. And so you had a sort of conflation of the whole thing where probably innocent Iraqi detainees were rounded up. For example, many of the detainees that we know were appeared in those photos at Abu Ghraib, we later learned, were just ordinary thieves. Some of them were innocent. Some of them were, you know, were simply ordinary Iraqis who had nothing to do with the insurgency and the terror. And so what you had was this process, because of, I think, a lack of policy direction from the very top, you had a process by which the whole approach to interrogation began to expand to deal with thousands and thousands of people who had nothing to do with this original core response in the war on terror.
Mike Shorey?
I would just make a quick point on what Mr. Hirsch said. It was indeed, it's indeed true that the agency asked for memorandums from the Department of Justice about what was permissible. But it wasn't done because we wanted to do it. It was done because we knew the politicians would abandon the agency. As for example, we've seen with Mr. Clark and Mr. Berger not coming forth to say that this was a presidentially authorized and sanctioned program. You always, as the intelligence service in the United States, want the politicians to sign up, because otherwise, if something goes south, they will be nowhere to be found until, you know, they surface now with Mr. McCain and the rest of them beating their chests over this righteousness of theirs.
Mike Shorey, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Mr. Conan. Thank you.
Mike Shorey, former chief of the Bin Laden Unit for the Central Intelligence Agency, author also of the book Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror.
Now, wait a damn minute. Did Cohen just say that Shorey was the former chief of the Bin Laden Unit? Now, you just had this ex-CIA.
That's right.
CIA guy on, who is the former chief of the Bin Laden Unit, and you didn't ask him nothing about Bin Laden? Mr. Extraordinary Rendition, who was talking about this has been the most successful program. Well, where's Uncle Ben? Where's Ben? I mean, how can you have the ex-chief of the Bin Laden Unit on and not ask him about old Uncle Ben? Was he the one who visited him at the hospital when he was on the dialysis machine? I mean, this is a scam. This exposes the whole thing right there. How sick and hypocritical this whole process is. So you can see how it ties in with this little pathetic Newsweek clown, Michael Hirsch, babbling about there were probably some innocent Iraqi detainees, but there was a problem of a lack of direction. What are you talking about, fool? Rumsfeld and all of these guys were working and commandeering this post. You had Gonzalez and all of them make up excuses and pseudo legal arguments to justify. They knew what they were planning. I mean, that's what Gonzalez's role was. You had top army officers like Sanchez be directly implicated in this whole process and actually talk about using German shepherds on the people. So for them to just play this scam of a game gives an indication of how deeply embedded the contempt for humanity this empire is, at all levels, the corporate media level, to the PR spinners, to these CIA goons. Now, to expose on another level Sam's roots of contemptness of justice. You know, often this type of barbarity leads, when we're dealing with the American experience, back to the black experience in America. In 1906, Ed Johnson from Chattanooga, Tennessee, was accused of raping a white woman, Nevada Taylor. Johnson was a laborer and had many alibis, and the alibis were strong testimonies that he was miles away. But one person accused Ed Johnson basically for a $350 reward. Nevada Taylor couldn't ID Johnson herself. She was in such a bad state, she didn't know if the rapist was black or white. But it didn't matter. In a land and in a court that is in contempt of any form of true justice.
It was really a sham of a trial. I mean, you had all white men in the jury, of course. A juror actually, during the middle of the trial, attacks Ed Johnson, the defendant, and yells out across the room in front of everyone, "If I could get at him right now, I would tear his heart out." Not shockingly, they found him guilty. The judge sentenced him to die. And then, in an extraordinary thing that had never happened before, these two black lawyers from the Atlanta and Chattanooga area step forward and they take his case into federal court, and that had never happened before. This was a state criminal case, a death penalty case, and they asked the federal courts to intervene. And for the first time in history, the U.S. Supreme Court agrees to do so, and they actually stay the first ever execution. They stay at Johnson's execution, and it appears, according to their own writings, they're about to release Ed Johnson, find him innocent, and instead the sheriff, led by his deputies, before that can happen, and about 500 people from Chattanooga take Ed Johnson out of the jail, and they lynch him.
Now, during this time in American history, the federal and Supreme Courts had never intervened in state courts. And they basically looked at it as state rights issues, in part because, see, remember right after the Civil War, when Reconstruction happened, black people were gaining a lot of rights. And then black people were abandoned by the federal government because the capitalists really, it didn't matter what happened to black people in their minds and from their perspective. So let the planters of the South have at it, which is basically what happened. They passed all these laws, black codes, you know, things to disarm the black population, gun control laws for within the black codes, various things to destroy the Reconstruction period through terror, like we've previously been talking about, in the form of the Klan and other state-sponsored institutions. Now, once that whole process happened, and how in part that happened, was the federal courts and Supreme Courts pulled back and allowed, quote-unquote, states' rights, you know, what they were doing in Georgia, what they were doing in Alabama, reign, so to speak. So, the Supreme Court never ruled during this whole process and all through 1906 that you had a Fourth, Fifth, or Sixth Amendment right in state court. I mean, that didn't even evolve until the 1950s and 60s. So laws like search and seizure, not testifying against yourself, a right to counsel, a trial by peers. You had no right to a fair trial, is what I'm saying. In many of these states, it was a states' rights issue. And within that vehicle, they were allowed for state-sponsored control and terror. Now, there was one Justice John Marshall Harlan. He was in the Supreme Court. He didn't like, in certain aspects, what was going on in the process of how these issues were obviously, though, a violation of laws in general. But here's first some background on this Supreme Court justice to kind of develop what I'm saying.
John Marshall Harlan was this interesting character. He was a big man, about 6'5". He weighed about 280, 290 pounds. He was bald on top, except these flaming red hairs on the side. And he was from Kentucky. And he was a state politician who, while he was running for public office, was pro-segregation. But then immediately he gets put on the Supreme Court, and immediately his views totally change. It's amazing what lifetime tenure, will do for your views. And he, if you may recall, wrote the dissenting opinion in the case of Plessy v. Ferguson, the case which basically legalized the Jim Crow laws of the time. And he was the lone dissenter, in which he wrote in there, the Constitution is colorblind. And he had this truly moralistic view. They call it now in law school, they teach us that it's a naturalist view. And that is that the Constitution is there to just protect us from government wrongdoings, and that it's there to help just make things right. If you're a strict constructionist, you don't believe this, but he was more in the idea that the Constitution was there to just help protect and make things right. And this is what he saw the Constitution in being. And he was, according to his own writings, he was looking for the right case in which to say, you know, you should have a Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial in state courts. It was going to be difficult to bring the other justices around to it, but he believed if he had the right case with a really bad fact base, he could do it. And this was the case. He thought, you know, having jurors attacking the defendant in the courtroom and his own lawyers abandoned him during the trial and there being lynching attempts throughout the whole trial and leading up to the trial, that how in the world can this be a fair trial? And that you need the federal constitution to step in and protect individual rights when the state law won't do so.
So you see what's kind of happening. Harlan basically believed, you know, through his particular natural law concept, that the Constitution provided a safeguard and protection for all its citizens. He wasn't really concerned with blacks, but through the super exploitation and contradiction that black people are in, of course, these types of the case are going to be exposed in its most dynamic form. So within that particular situation, the case ends up coming up. And, so when you have a person's own lawyer jumping ship from the case and people trying to lynch you and all of that, you can see how it could. And when two black lawyers step in afterwards, and they take this case to the Supreme Court for appeals on a federal habeas, the Supreme Court, seeing all of these contradictions pushed by Harlan, decides to give a 10-day stay of execution. And at this point, this is where you start to see the contempt of court emerge by individuals like Sheriff, who after lynching Johnson, in contempt of the Supreme Court's 10-day stay, it helps explore how race and racism explode the contradictions of the system. So this ends up being the first time where the Supreme Court really puts its foot down on the state, because now here you have people within a state violating their own instructions. They ordered a 10-day stay of execution. And then you have these guys like a sheriff, this little sheriff clown, basically go and take Johnson and execute him anyway, and then send a note to the leave a note pinned up on Johnson mocking the Supreme Court and Harlan in particular. This is why the Supreme Court found itself in an outrage.
Mind, the Supreme Court of the United States is an appellate court. It hears reviews from decisions made by the lower courts, be it state courts or other lower federal courts. Here you have the Supreme Court issuing a stay of execution, saying that no, it wants to review the Ed Johnson conviction. Then the sheriff and his deputies and members of lynch mob kill Ed Johnson. That just sends the Supreme Court into an outrage. They see their authority, their power is being impugned. So they order the arrest of the sheriff and his deputies. Contempt charges are brought, first and, as you pointed out, first and only time in history where anyone has ever been charged
with violating a Supreme Court order, and it's put on trial right there in the Supreme Court of the United States. And this is truly the historic part of this case, and that is, keep in mind, at this point in history, lynchings were just rampant across the country. Between 1890 and 1906, there were 2,100 lynchings that had taken place in that 16-year time span. 2,100. And in not one of those lynchings was any individual ever arrested, charged, or prosecuted for participating in any of those lynchings. And the Supreme Court justices, when you read their notes back and forth to each other, they were really concerned that the rule of law was in jeopardy in this country. They were really afraid that if they didn't take action, that then the rule of law itself would just totally evaporate and be undermined.
So at that point, see, it's kind of how, like, the contradictions of slavery and the forces of slavery ended up exploding out in its contradictions. Slave states, those who basically made their capitalist exploitation off of wage slaves, you know, people they had to pay a wage, primarily in the North, and then the planters who had slaves who they didn't have to pay a wage to. Yet it was all within the same country. How could you have a developing, viable country, capitalist version, develop all within itself? So one has to give. It has to go all slave, or it has to be all free. Neither side were willing to bend for their own particular purposes, talking about the rulers, and then thus you have the explosion. Well, by the same token, you have a situation where you have those who are in various powers within the judicial system believe in the rule and rule of law, law and order construct, and you have a population who's violating it. Now, they happen to be violating it in the name of keeping black people in the place, but it's gotten so rampant and out of control that even when they try, meaning the judicial courts try to say, hey, look, cool it on this particular issue, because they want to flex their own power and they know the corrosive aspect if it just spirals out of control. They are insulted when these guys basically thumb their nose. So that contradiction, which they of course helped ferment by pulling back, as I first was talking about, during the Reconstruction period, to basically let the South have go at black people, now has in its own contradictions of violence, sickness, hatred, disregard for human life, imploded all over them. And now they're trying to rein it in. 2,100 lynchings in a 16-year period. Now, what this also helps expose the whole states and complicity in this. There's a book called Without Sanctuary. It's a book on lynch postcards. Basically, it has the postcards that white people would take and make of black people that they lynched. So they would often take pictures of black people, make postcards out of them, send it to their relatives. Now, these postcards, of course, went through the whole system. You know, because To be a postcard and go through the whole stamping procedure basically means it is something that's within the whole system that exposes that the system itself saw these people's faces, didn't care, let them go on and on and on. Now, the Supreme Court was worried about this whole rule of law being undermined. Now, white law and order advocates are obviously criminal hypocrites, you know, because these are the same type that will cry about Schiavo, you know, and but have Randall Terry call for an abortion doctor's death, you know, and be a spokesman for Schiavo's parents. This helps expose the type of mentality and contradiction that these people live with without any hesitation. But next, what also goes into is the testimony was taken by the Supreme Court in the case of the sheriff in this contempt of court case. In other words, after he did what he did, they took him to court and tried him in the Supreme Court. But they didn't try him for murder. They tried him for contempt of court.
Well, the Supreme Court actually ordered a trial to take place, and they appointed a special master to go to Chattanooga to take evidence. And several hundred individuals, including all the defendants, the sheriff, everyone involved or anyone who had information, was required to be put under oath in federal court and were to be given statements, and testimony was taken. The testimony was then sent, each witness's testimony was then sent to the Supreme Court, which reviewed it. In the end, the Supreme Court decided that the sheriff, Sheriff Joseph Shipp, one of his deputies, and five members of the lynch mob, that there was significant evidence, overwhelming evidence, that they indeed not only had participated in Ed Johnson's lynching, but that they specifically sought to conspire together to thwart the Supreme Court order, i.e. contempt of the Supreme Court of the United States. And then they decided to find them guilty of those charges, those seven individuals. Just the whole fact that the Supreme Court would come down there and interfere, that was the word that was used by the local officials. How dare the Supreme Court even interfere in our state court business? And then that they would come down and arrest the sheriff and put him on trial and lock him up. I mean, it was seen as a complete outrage. Now, keep in mind, some of the members of the Supreme Court, particularly Justice Harlan and Oliver Wendell Holmes, argued for considerably more time, a year or more. But the other members of the court just simply felt that 90 days with a contempt statute was just simply as far as they could go. One of the great opinions in this case was written on December 24th, 1906, by Oliver Wendell Holmes, and it was a unanimous opinion. And the sheriff's lawyers had argued that you can't find my client, the sheriff, his deputies, and members of lynch mob in contempt because your original efforts to intervene in the state criminal case were totally null and void. You didn't have the authority to do that. And if you didn't have the authority to intervene and stay Ed Johnson's execution, you didn't have the authority to find my clients, the lawyer's clients, the sheriff and his deputies, in guilty of violating that order. And on December 24th, 1906, Oliver Wendell Holmes, in the unanimous opinion, wrote that, no, we're the Supreme Court of the United States, and if we say we have the authority, we have the authority. And it really is a truly amazing opinion. As a matter of fact, Thurgood Marshall used to require some of his law clerks to actually read that specific opinion in their first few days on the court.
So this helps expose the contradictions that happened and how the federal government ended up flexing its muscle to basically rein in a population that under their wing, more or less, but they had at the same time used that same population and its vileness to basically be inhumane and savage towards his desired people. But at the end of the day, it's clear that they were only interested in themselves, because the contempt of court case was all they charged him with, not murder, which he was guilty of. And what was his sentence that they had set up? 90 days for him, 60 days for his thuggish friends. So while the federal court ruling is seen by some as a relief for Black, it was built off a false foundation, and the courts were not concerned with Black justice, just its maintenance of law and order, the rule of law and authority outlined by the state, in a sick, brutal, insane, savage, white justice, Black misery society. Sisters and brothers, how many stories must we sing in this tune?
did get in. I'd love to know some African Americans. After pursuing a direct appeal, 6 years later, on February 17th of 2000, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court awarded me a new trial on the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. When we began the retrial, new counsel discovered that there was an eyewitness to the shooting who originally told the police during one of the proceedings in the first trial that I was not the person who he seen shoot his friend and brother of the sister who he was dating at the time of the murder. After hearing this new evidence, the jury believed them and decided to find me not guilty on all charges. What's so outrageous about it is that the prosecutor knew the identity of this eyewitness. The police knew of the identity of this eyewitness. They both spoke to this eyewitness previously, prior to the first trial. And yet they were willing to oppose a new trial and continue to conceal the identity of this eyewitness who apparently exonerated me. I fit the profile to death, but I was convicted and sentenced to death.
White justice, black misery, the legal and illegal lynching of a people. The past and current realities of the U.S. government's state-sponsored legal executions and lynchings by racist white mobs of black people is an American tradition. And what we find in this tradition is a tradition of terror. What we also find are strong similarities in state-sponsored murders and racist mob murders. For example, often the truth doesn't matter. Often true justice of one's rights doesn't matter. Just the bloodlust of a violent racist nation that stands firm in the air of all of its hypocrisy. New York Times, June 11th, 1900. An innocent man lynched. A mob willfully and knowingly hanged and burned an innocent man as well as another who was probably innocent near Mississippi City. Between midnight and 1 o'clock this morning, the lynching was the result of impatience on the part of the people of Biloxi, a nearby town, over the failure of the officers of the law to produce the man who a week ago murdered Christina Winterstein, a schoolgirl, who was returning to her home near Biloxi after attending the commencement exercises of her school. The crime was an unusually atrocious one, even for outrages of this nature, and naturally, suspicion pointed to some unknown Negro as the perpetrator. Many arrests were made, and two of the suspects, Askew and Russ, were placed in the Mississippi jail for safekeeping. The proof against neither was more than remotely circumstantial. In the case of Askew, the district attorney made an examination and practically declared the man innocent. The next night, Askew was taken from the jail by a mob and tortured with fire to extort a confession. After the horrible ordeal, the mob declared the man innocent, but later changed their mind, took him back, and riddled his body to pieces. That was then. This is now. In 1981 through 1995, now to the year 2005, the attempted lynching of Mumia Abu-Jamal. When Jamal's former lawyer, Jackson, hit the stand a while back during Jamal's appeals process in 1995, Jackson testified that he didn't want to be Jamal's lawyer during the original trial because he was ill-prepared and ill-financed less than $4,000 during the original trial. He had himself removed, but the Judge Sable, the state head henchman, ordered Jackson back. Jamal's former lawyer revealed how the coroner's department, the police, and the prosecution withheld evidence in which Jackson said showed that the bullet that killed the cop that Mumia was convicted of killing was a .44 caliber out of a .44 caliber gun. Mumia's gun that he carried with him while he drove his taxi at night was a .38. Jackson then stated that Sable then removed a black juror and allowed a white juror to sit in who admitted that he was antagonistic against Jamal. At that point during the appeals testimony, Judge Sable, who was also residing over the appeals hearing, stopped Jackson in mid-testimony stating that he had to go out and get a sandwich. In other words, I'm sick of hearing the facts of the probable innocent of Jamal's "let's just lynch this nigga." The Sable and his FOP henchmen had it their way. Mumia's case would have probably worked out like this. New York Crail, July 24th, 1900. Lynched before trial. Elijah Clark, a Negro, 20 years old, was lynched at 2 o'clock this afternoon by an immense mob of citizens of Huntsville and the surrounding county. Clark was about to be removed from the Madison County Jail to the courthouse for a preliminary hearing when the mob compelled the officers to give him up, took him to the scene of his crime, hanged him, and riddled the body with bullets. That was then. This is now. It now appears that many people involved and claimed they listened to the OJ criminal trial, including some of the victim's family members, would have preferred the Elijah Clark way, lynched before trial. But then, of course, there's the classic, find a Negro. Any Negro? Lynch a Negro. Chicago Record Hill, July 15th, 1903. Tonight, while his victim, Miss Susie Johnson, looked on. Claus was captured after being tracked through 7 counties by 50 farmers. Claus attacked Miss Johnson last Thursday as she was returning from a small school where she teaches. The Negro kept her prisoner for several hours, and she found next morning by a searching party. A posse organized, and the Negro was trailed from here almost to Savannah Hand before he was overtaken. He was brought here tonight by his captors and taken to the home of Miss Johnson. The young woman identified him, and when asked what she wanted done with him, she said, quote, "He ought to be killed." The Negro was then tied to a tree, and the members of the mob fired at him until he was literally cut into pieces. Chicago Record Herald. July 27, 1903. Wrong man lynched is rapist. Several days ago, a Negro supposed to be Ed Claus was lynched near Eastman, Georgia, for assaulting Miss Susie Johnson, a young school teacher. The Negro protested he was not Claus and asked for time to prove his statement, but the mob was merciless. It now transpires that the Negro was not Claus and had never seen Miss Johnson. Claus, who assaulted the girl, was located near Durance, Georgia. Officers passed through here tonight to secure him. It is believed Claus will be taken from the officers and lynched. New York Age, April 30th, 1914. The brother of a young colored girl who was lynched by a mob by white ruffians near Wagner, Oklahoma, a few weeks ago, passed through this way on his way to Mexico. He gave a pathetic account of the lynching to colored citizens here. The young man's sister was but 17 years old and of respectable parents. Two half-drunken white men walked into their home during the absence of the mother and found the girl dressing, locked themselves in her room, and criminally assaulted her. Her screams for help were heard by her brother, who, kicking down the door, went to rescue her. In defending his sister, he shot one of the brutes. The other escaped. Later in the evening, the authorities, failing to find her brother, arrested the sister. Find a Negro, any Negro, lynch a Negro. Who was taken from jail by a mob at 4 o'clock in the morning and lynched. From his hiding place, the brother, who was 21 years old, could hear his sister's cry for help, but was powerless to aid her. That was then. This is now. In 1980, a 16-year-old white girl named Cheryl D. Ferguson was raped and murdered. The suspicion of the murder turned to the school's 5 janitors. One of the school's janitors later testified that the cops looked at Clarence Bradley, the only black janitor, and said, quote, "Since you're the nigger, you're elected," unquote. Bradley was later convicted and sentenced to death by an all-white jury. It was found later that the prosecution intentionally suppressed evidence of Bradley's innocence and had their witnesses perjure themselves. After a tremendous battle, all charges were dropped, and Bradley was set free after spending 10 years in jail in this travesty of justice. One's innocence doesn't always matter. Often just the color of one's skin. Even the presiding judge in Bradley's appeals case admitted as much. Quote, "The court unequivocally concludes that the color of Clarence Bradley's skin was a substantial factor that pervaded all aspects in the state's capital prosecution of him." Unquote. In other words, white justice, black misery. But not all of the convicted innocent get also lucky. Take the case of Lionel Herrera. America's white light of justice shines horribly clear. The nephew of the true murderer came forward, stating that he witnessed his uncle kill this person. His uncle then turned to him and threatened to kill him if he ever said anything. The nephew, who was not in his teens, and at the time, because of his youthful age, complied with his uncle's threat. But after many years had passed, the nephew, now a young adult, stepped forward with the truth about Herrera's innocence to his attorneys and presented this to them. The attorneys presented with this and other strong new evidence reveals Rivera's probable innocence. The attorneys asked for the case to be reopened to prevent the ultimate miscarriage of justice, the execution of an innocent man. The Department of Justice countered, stating that since Herrera had a fair trial, quote-unquote, the first time, and was violently sentenced, the new evidence supporting Herrera's claim of innocence was irrelevant, quote-unquote. The Supreme Court agreed and rejected Herrera's appeals to reopen the case. Herrera, a most probable innocent man, was executed. Once again, white justice, black, wait, hold on a sec. In this case, brown misery, which should be a good lesson for other persons of color in this society, some of whom think that they can slide by. Sam nearly exterminated the red from this hemisphere, dropped the bomb on the yellow, and is 187 brown from their own land. And well, white justice, black misery. We know what the hell he's doing to black. The Supreme Court has ruled that condemned prisoners who have exhausted their appeals have no constitutional rights on having their cases being heard by the federal courts, even when evidence supports their innocence. What the courts are saying, in effect, is that if the states follow its laws and procedures, even if those laws and procedures are racist, sexist, and biased against the poor, then that's a fair trial, and you can be executed on that basis, guilty or not. White justice, black misery. Even if one's mental facilities are not quite there, it doesn't matter to a lawless, brutal government and its lawless, racist mobs of holy terror. Montgomery Advertiser, August 25th, 1913. Negro half-wit is lynched, threatened to lynch whites. Deputy Sheriff David Kennebrook today reported the lynching of Wilson Gardner, a young Negro half-wit who was found Sunday hanging by a belt. Gardner had gone around to the homes of white miners near Kilgore, carrying a rope and threatening to hang them. This disturbed the miners, who beat the half-wit to death before hoisting his corpse to a railroad trestle. That was then. This is now. In 1992, Bill Clinton signed the papers to have lobotomized half-wit Ricky Ray Rector put to death. Rector was in such a lost and poor mental state that when they came to take him to his execution table, he asked him to save his pecan pie because he liked to eat it before he went to bed at night. And as they were strapping him down to destroy him, he commented on how he was going to vote for the then presidential candidate, Bill Clinton. Clinton himself flew back to Arkansas to witness this execution. One must ask, what has truly changed? Certainly not white justice, black misery. For it is in our hands to change this madness. For those in power are not looking for true justice, just justice American style. A while back, executor former President Bill Clinton passed his own crime bill, Part 1 and Part 2, and the Effective Death Penalty and Anti-Terrorism Act, which really means, ain't I the terrorist? Yes, Bill, you are. For in those bills, it reduces the number of appeals one is allowed after they are convicted. But in a staff report issued on October 21st, 1993, by the Subcommittee on Civil and Constitutional Rights called Innocence and the Death Penalty, it documented 48 persons who have been released from prison since 1973. After strong evidence and agitation for their release was won, now that release of innocence is over 100. Many of these innocent inmates would have probably been destroyed if Clinton's bill of crime had been passed while they were still in prison fighting for their appeals. That's the crime, Bill. That the death penalty is not designed for justice, but rather as a terror weapon leased out on the masses. The crime Bill and his supporters of death ignore is that the fact that large numbers of innocent known persons have been executed over the last few decades. But that's just it. The legal and illegal lynchings have never been about true justice, but about the violent terror of control used to suppress its desired targets. That, in America's capitalist system, translates to, amongst all other things, to white justice, black misery. This has been Tracy James with a commentary, White Justice, Black Misery, the legal and illegal lynching of a people. Out. That's just going about to wrap it up for Slave. It's clear that we're in the hour of chaos, and black steel is at hand for our own particular survival. We can't depend on a justice system that is in contempt of our rights and of life and of humanity. Check you out next time. Slave. Out.
A ballad behind bars, or you could say real rock from the rock. An unusual musical happening in a most unusual place. The state prison
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it. It said they were suckers. They wanted me for their army or whatever. Picture me giving a damn. I said never. Here's a land that never gave a damn about a brother like me and myself, because they never did. I wasn't with it, but just that very minute it occurred to me. The suckers had authority.